This is Ron Orl, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited to welcome to the program Derek Zaba, partner in Sidley's Palo Alto and New York offices and co-chair of the law firm's shareholder activism practice. And we've already had one of Sidley's, the other co-chair on the inaugural 8 podcast a few years ago, Kai Likafet, who Derek works with. So pretty exciting. Between Derek and Kai, Sidley has rocketed up the ranks in the activism defense world and is typically ranked at the top of the league tables this league for a number of campaigns under their belt. So we are super excited to have Derek on the show. Thanks, Derek, for taking the time.
And thank you, Ron. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. So maybe start off and tell us a little bit about you and your background and why you're located in both Palo Alto and New York.
Happy to do that. So I have a non-traditional background, I'd say, for attorneys. Certainly an attorney doing what I do. I actually started in the business world working for Capital One, coming out of undergrad with a business and applied math degree. So the promise of Capital One back then was, you know, you could go somewhere else and you could spend 5 years getting them to trust your judgment, or you could come here because they were at the vanguard of using information and data to drive decisions. You could come here and make decisions at day one, so long as you could support it with the data we have available. And so that was a very attractive proposition. So I started Capital One, but always figured I would go back to law school at some point. And at the height of the dot-com boom and bust, I applied to law school and ended up out here on the West Coast, Stanford, which is why I'm on the West Coast now. I circled back to this. In the meantime, post Stanford, I moved to New York and spent 10 years there, both working for Wachtell Lipton for a few years and at an event-driven hedge fund, at which I invested in situations that were ongoing significant corporate change, including activism, and transitioned to another hedge fund where I was a partner at the activist hedge fund. From there, I moved to Camberview Partners, another advisory firm where I eventually led the activism defense practice and contested situations defense practice, which also included contested M&A. And when Camberview was acquired, I'd worked with Kai and I'd worked with Sidley many times in my various roles and joined Kai, was very impressed by what he had built. I joined Kai, and now it was just a few years ago. It seems like longer, but I think it was in summer of 2019, right before the whole pandemic.
Yeah, no, and that's interesting that you came over when Camberview was acquired. And definitely, yeah, we've been following Sidley's kind of, obviously this is an issue that's dominated by a few law firms, and Sidley has kind of come out of nowhere in the last 5 years to lead in activist defense. So it's pretty exciting to see a new player doing so strong. So, okay, so let's get into some of the kind of trends in activism type stuff. And at the deal, obviously, we're really focused a lot on the M&A related aspects of activism. And I guess I wanted to ask you whether you feel with the diminished M&A market lately, how that might impact activism. And, it's interesting. I just wrote an article about this JANA Partners campaign at Freshpet, where they want the company to consider M&A. And this is kind of a disruptor in the pet food industry. It's kind of frozen fresh pet, and it's kind of a first mover that apparently all the pet food companies are supposedly interested in buying. The analysts I talked to seem skittish about the idea of M&A in the near term. And I believe that, that makes sense in light of the market conditions. But I don't know. What do you think? I mean, do you think activists will continue to push for deals in this market, or will they focus more on pushing out CEOs? We saw with Ancora, there was a campaign by McCallum at Kohl's that Callum wanted a sale. They lost the proxy contest and the auction happened. There was no sale. And now Ancora wants the CEO removed. I'm wondering if that could be more of a trend in the near term.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And I'm not going to speak to directly about any specific situation, but I think as a general trend, you will see more pushes for activism regardless of the M&A market. And the M&A market, I think even if you have issues in the financing market, you do have strategics. And so to the extent that you are pushing for strategic buyers, there may be more viability, but there's still plenty of private equity firms with plenty of money to spend. And if they need to put a little more equity in, then at a price, they're all willing to do it. I think the M&A and more transactional type theses are just more attractive in this type of market, in a market which is, there's a lot of uncertainty. We have inflation, which we have a whole generation of investment analysts at hedge funds and investment banks that have never really dealt with positive interest rates and increasing interest rates. And so there's just a lot of uncertainty in the investment community for the people making the decisions as to how it's going to impact the world, how it's going to impact the investments. And so M&A theses and transactional type theses are generally shorter duration, right? If you're trying to get some company sold, you're trying to do it right away. You're trying to, you know, it's not a 3-year operational type thesis. In a world where there's a lot of uncertainty, that's a much more attractive proposition for a lot of these funds that are dedicated activist funds that have to put money in activism and may be more reluctant to put it in companies where you have to commit yourself to a multi-year campaign. So I think you'll see continued pushes for M&A. We saw, if you look at the downturn for COVID, where it affected across the market, and whereas this one is obviously very differentiated by industry and subsector, but across the market, we didn't see activists so much pushing for M&A, but we did see a lot of hostile acquirers. And so there still were pushes, there still were buyers. I think in that situation, it was so unprecedented that most folks were just trying to stay in business and not, you know, take on too much risk with any type of investment strategy where we had to take on a bunch of risks. So it was really on the hostile acquirer standpoint. But I use that as an example of even in that situation, you do have buyers. And if you have buyers that want a strategic asset and that asset was 2x what it is now, you can pay a pretty healthy premium and still justify the acquisition. So I think regardless of the M&A markets as a whole, the hostile M&A markets or the desire for strategic assets or an asset which private equity firms are willing to put a little more equity in, there's still plenty of room for activists to attempt to demand an M&A outcome. I think the CEO is different, like the desire to oust CEOs. I think that's always been a big part of activism, continues to be a big part of activism. And even when activists don't say that outright, it's often in the specter. It's often harder for an activist to get support for a campaign where you're ousting the CEO because it is such a drastic change. So a lot of times I think it remains unsaid what an activist is pushing for other things, but that's something that, you know, has been around, is around, and will continue to be around for activism for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I feel like almost every day now I'm writing about a company installing a poison pill. And some of those are response to activists, and some of those are response to hostile bidders. And those hostile bidders often want to do director contests. So you're right. That is a kind of an angle on activism we are seeing more of. I consider hostile bidders with proxy contests under the umbrella of activism. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a bit about some of the governance and executive compensation things that activists push for. And I'm wondering if you think that governance issues and executive compensation will be a big part of activist campaigns in the months to come. You know, it's interesting. I spoke to an activist not too long ago who has an ESG element to their executive compensation effort. I don't know. Do you think that the governance issues will continue to be a part of activist campaigns, pointing out overboarded, over tenured directors at companies? And do you think executive compensation will be a big part? And if executive compensation, what about executive compensation?
So if you think of the world of what I would term, you know, non-economic or not directly economic or small g governance type of arguments, which are always, you know, part of an activist campaign, they're really under, I'd say, four letters. We have to use ESG because those are very popular letters these days. And I would add C to that as compensation as a separate subsector. And if you think about that historically, you know, governance has always been part of activism. And then, you know, think of the rise of ISS and some of the pushback in the 80s started with governance. And at the end of the day, we're talking about the ultimate tool for an activist is removal of a board member, which in that sense is a governance issue. So governance has always been around. Compensation's been around, it seems like a long time, really since Dodd-Frank, right? Compensation has been integrated into activist campaigns, compensation structure, long-term compensation incentives. So I think both of those have been a big part of activism and will continue to be a big part of activism. The real question is, to what extent are the E and the S, the environmental and the social, going to be parts of activism campaigns going forward? And it's tougher. I think historically, it's been tougher to integrate those. You can't really say with a straight face, hey, I think you should sell the company, get a big premium. Oh, and by the way, your carbon footprint's too big. So why don't you work on that as well? It's just such a non sequitur that it reduces the credibility of the campaign. And now you've seen a more concerted effort of activists trying to integrate the E and the S. We saw, obviously, you know, campaigns in the energy space relating to climate, which, you know, we call it environmental, but really the issue is emissions. And so energy and energy adjacent industries, it can make sense. But in other industries, it's really forced. But social issues, we're seeing a lot of that pop up. And everything with the boards are taking on greater oversight responsibilities. There's not more of that oversight being pushed into committees. And so a lot of things such as, you know, that can be described as cultural issues or employee issues. And any company that is having issues probably has some employee discontent because things aren't all, you know, hunky-dory when an activist shows up. There's clearly some issues at the company. Can be described as, you know, a failure of tone at the top, a cultural issue, a failure of oversight, human capital management. And so we're seeing much more of that. And interestingly, or I guess amazingly to me, is how much the Glassdoor plays into these campaigns. You know, Glassdoor, which if you're a company of any size, of course, you're going to have some employees that are posting things that are negative about the company, the CEO, and the culture. And so we see Glassdoor and these quotes and complaints against the CEO really coming into campaigns in an accelerated fashion, trying to capture this concern about oversight of human capital management. And I think that's the, you know, social is probably an area with human capital management and other places within social that I think you'll see more activists try to integrate those more into their campaigns. And like I said, we're seeing a decent amount of it.
That's interesting. Do you think that there'll be proxy contests tied to social campaigns or campaigns that include a social element? And is there a relationship? Are these campaigns, do they often are connected to M&A campaigns at companies or?
Yeah, and I think there's two parts, right? There's the traditional activist campaigns where these types of issues are woven in, and that's really what I was speaking about. So, you know, you want to improve the company, you want to get the CEO fired, and so, you know, you complain about culture and call it a failure of human capital management. I think there's a whole other set of, well, are there going to be campaigns that are based, you know, especially with the Universal Proxy Card, based solely on these types of social issues? And I think that's a whole separate discussion. The social issues by themselves are a lot tougher to get traction versus the emissions issue because environmental is just such a big deal across the entire institutional investor spectrum. But yes, there, I think you will see people exploring those as potential avenues to express their views on these topics.
Very interesting. So you mentioned the Universal Proxy Card and your partner, Kai, has said on at least a couple of occasions, I've noticed, that activists are, and I quote, popping the champagne corks now that the Universal Proxy Card rules are in effect. And just for our audience that isn't that familiar with this new approach or new rules for proxy director contest, these rules came into effect on September 1st, and they basically allow institutional investors to have more flexibility to pick and choose among their incumbent and dissident candidates in a situation where an activist has a dissident slate of directors. And without getting into too much of the details, there, I guess there's some speculation that some activists could take advantage of the new cards to kind of almost like a free rider effect where they don't have to solicit a lot of investors themselves. They can just, you know, the company has to distribute the cards to all the investors and they could get their names on the company's proxy cards. And you know, this is going to result in this huge explosion of new, very inexpensive proxy contests that, and it sounds, Derek, like you were suggesting we might see some social themed proxy contest now that the Universal Proxy Card is making that less expensive in addition to the traditional hedge fund contest. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of issues. I mean, we could probably spend a couple hours debating and discussing all the issues and the implications of the Universal Proxy Card, because I think they are, to those that are not on the inside, it seems pretty straightforward for shareholder democracy, and that's the words that are used. But there's actually a lot of impacts within the way that this is played. Potential replacement of proxy access, which never really took off, and using this, that is a possibility. And just to describe what it is, it's really prior to September 1st of this year, when you were voting in a contest, for all practical purposes, you had to pick a side, right? There were two cards. There was a company card. There was a dissident card. And you had to pick a card that you were going to support. And the dissident had their candidates, the company had their candidates. You didn't need to support the entire slate, but you couldn't mix and match. You couldn't pick some from the company card and some from the dissident card. And this really forced investors to, at first, when their analysis decide, do I support the company or do I support the activist? And having two cards really forced that decision. It was going to be difficult to vote on the dissident card if you liked the director and their skill set, so on and so forth, but didn't necessarily support dissident slate. Nowadays, after in the Universal Proxy Card world, there really isn't that decision that is forced upon investors. You have a list of candidates, some are from the dissident, some are from the company, and you can mix or match. And I think the concern is, and my concern, and there's a number of concerns, but the concern is that some investors may vote for directors that they believe should be on, you know, makes sense if in the context of designing a board and based on their skill sets, based on the diversity, so on and so forth. But those directors may come with a mandate. If an activist wins one or two seats on the board, historically, it's been the case that it's been perceived as an activist win. Every single company that measures whether a company wins or an activist wins based on uses the metric that the company has to win everything. The company has to have zero candidates on, win all the candidates, they win. If the activist gets one, they win. And so you can have a situation where it is perceived as an activist win, where the activist is claiming the mandate, where one or two people were elected simply because investors like their skill set. And in fact, the majority of investors didn't support the activist thesis, but they just thought that the company needed a little bit of change in the board composition, or frankly, just liked an investor or liked the board member of the activist slate above that on the company slate, and had nothing to do with whether they thought the company needed more change. They just thought that was the right person. I have some real concerns with how the results of these campaigns will be interpreted. Mm-hmm. And that also, I think, which my biggest concern is, and I think this is, if you could look at a second order effect, is if that's the case, and if it really is easier for dissidents to get more people on, then how is that going to affect the early stage campaigns, the campaigns that really settle? The vast majority of campaigns settle and don't go to a contest. And if the dissidents believe they have the advantages downstream in the ballot box, if they believe that they might get support for their nominees, even if they don't get support for their campaign, their thesis, is that going to make them more unreasonable in what they're proposing at the settlement stage? Is that going to make them come with bigger slates in order to try to pressure companies to settle for something that's more in their favor? So I think there's a lot of other effects to what is fairly simple change in voting mechanics that those on the outside that don't deal with this on a day-to-day basis don't fully appreciate.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. It's kind of counterintuitive in my mind that you think that this might result in less settlements, or I guess it could pressure companies to agree to settlements that are more advantageous to the activist because of the leverage that the activist might have because of the universal card. And you didn't even bring up proxy advisors, who are also probably popping the champagne corks in excitement because they have more flexibility to pick, you know, the combination of incumbent and dissident candidates that they'd like to in their recommendation reports, like Institutional Shelter Services or Glass Lewis. You know, what can it hurt to put one or two activists on the four-person dissident slate onto a board is the approach that I think could materialize here, I guess. But yeah. Anyways, is it that you think we might see more contests going the distance because of this? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, you know, I think we'll see more campaigns. Whether they settle or not, I think it's going to depend on how much activists change their demands. So I think if everything stayed the same, you probably would see more settlements because of the uncertainty on the company side of the outcome. But from what I'm hearing and what I expect activists to demand more. And whether that leads to more settlements or more situations that go, you know, all the way to a proxy contest, I think that remains to be seen. So we'll see how this plays out. But the thing that I guess is, I think, lost in this is, even if this affects, what are there, 20, 25, 30 contests that go to a vote every year, and maybe this will affect a handful of those contests. Now, for those companies and for me, that's going to be a very big deal. But in the grand scheme of corporate America with 4,000, 5,000 companies, that's not nearly as big. But if it affects the dynamics of the settlement market, which is an order of magnitude, order of magnitude and a half bigger than the vote market, then that's going to have a pretty big impact on the way things unfold in corporate America. And I think that's the piece of this that isn't fully appreciated, understood, and we'll see how it plays out. But I think that's the piece that could be really problematic if it plays out like I think.
Okay. And it's a reminder, Derek, for me that when an activist gets one seat on a 12-person board, I should not interpret that as the activist win and a new mandate necessarily for the whole company. Although I feel like that's how in a contest like Procter & Gamble, I was thinking Nelson Peltz, Procter & Gamble, one person on the board, that was a contest that went the distance. So, you know, there was millions of shares voted. Or even more than that. And so, you know, you could argue that that was a mandate for Nelson Peltz had won, that he got half the voting shares to support him. But I could see also your point that, you know, putting one person on the board in a settlement, let's say, is not necessarily, and that person is not, you know, doesn't work for the activist. He's some external person that has a lot of expertise, you know, isn't necessarily a mandate that, you know, that the company should do everything the activist wants.
Yeah, look, and I think it does depend. So if an activist is running two principals from the activist fund, and that's all they're running, they get two on, that's a different situation than if they're running 10 and they get one or two independents who are highly qualified, clearly independent from the activist, very accomplished people in their own right. One smacks of a mandate, whereas the other one really sounds much more like people like the director and not necessarily agreed with the dissident campaign.
Okay, absolutely. I totally agree with you on that. Okay, we're almost out of time, but I have one more question I wanted to ask. Mm-hmm. And it's on a subject that I'm kind of obsessed with, which is this, what I feel like I'm seeing an increasing amount of activists employing derivatives in their campaigns. And so the SEC has been very active lately. One rule they're considering relates to the increased disclosure of derivative positions. They have a proposal that hasn't been adopted yet, but it would require activists to disclose their position, even if they had, let's say, $300 million worth of derivatives. And it would have to disclose it, I think, over 24 hours, almost immediately, which is very different than the 13D disclosure, which they're considering changing from, you know, once you own 5% of a company, which can be considerably more than $300 million worth. But 5% of a company, when you cross it, you currently have 10 days to disclose. This would drop it to 5 days. But I just wanted to get a sense of this, you know, as the SEC decides whether they're going to adopt this derivatives rule. I've been hearing from some activists that some of these derivatives positions known as total return swaps or cash settled equity securities, that, the, you know, from activists saying that these do not give investors the ability to influence the company. And I don't know, I feel like if you have a huge derivatives position, let's say the equivalent of the largest position at a company, but it's in derivatives, not in common shares, that's a lot of leverage. And I don't know, what do you think?
I agree with you 100%. You know, the truth is the difference between derivative and common shares is only relevant once you pass the record date and get to a vote. And the vast, vast, vast majority of these situations don't get there. There's a settlement, there's pressure beforehand. And those derivatives could be converted, whether that's directly or whether that's through a sale of the derivatives and acquisition of common stock by the time the record date comes around. So if the activists have already shown an indication they're willing to get a certain level of economic exposure, there's no reason to think that they couldn't have the vote by the time it's necessary. I think the other piece that's just blatantly obvious is whenever an activist puts out a press release, they say, you know, we have $2 billion of economic exposure to the company. They don't say we own $50 million of common stock, even though that might be the case, mm-hmm. because saying $2 billion of economic exposure gives them credibility. And investors mm-hmm. view that very credibly. So if investors view it credibly, then of course they have leverage. Of course, the company treats them differently than if they showed up at a mega cap company and said, hey, I own $50 million worth of common stock. So I think this, that the notion that it doesn't give them almost exactly the same amount of leverage is just, you know, incorrect.
Okay. All right. That's what I was thinking, because I feel like I see a lot of situations where an activist shows up with a large economic exposure in a dollar figure to a company, and then you see their 13F and they have a, you know, a minuscule common share position. So and then, you know, you see settlements that happen between the activists with right. derivatives position and companies, or yep. informal or formal, or companies responding. So for me, it's easy to see that these derivatives do carry a large position. And so it'll be interesting to see also if the SEC does adopt this or some variation of this derivatives disclosure rule, and whether that might shift the calculus with some activists as they accumulate their positions, which I think they still will continue to do so, regardless of what I hear about from the activists about how this is going to be, it's an existential threat to their well-being and stuff like that. But anyways, Derek, we are out of time, and I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been Ron Orl, and you've been listening to the Activist Investment Today podcast, and we've been talking to Derek Szaba of Sidley. Thanks, Derek, for taking the time.
Thanks, Ron, for having me.